The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Dave's Gone By. 90 minutes of music, talk radio, comedy, and more, brought to you by Total Theater and Performing Arts Insider Magazine. Hope you had a great holiday. Hope you've made your New Year's plans, whether you're standing in the cold, risking pneumonia and a crushed pelvis in Times Square, or paying $100 to sit in some restaurant and eat $30 meals with a party hat on, or just staying home and watching Dick Clark finally starting to look a year older. But the pressure really feels off this year, you know? Remember 2000, the turning of the millennium? Only, I know, it really wasn't, because the know-it-alls made a big stink that 2001 was really the start of the new century. But December 31st, 1999, man, they made you feel that if you didn't have a table for 12 and a skyscraper overlooking all of Manhattan, with Hootie and the Blowfish as your private band and two suites at the Ritz-Carlton, well, you just weren't worthy of celebrating New Year's. Years in advance, people had pre-booked their New Year's Eve plans, and everybody fretted that their computers would go on the fritz because the clock system was based on the year 1900 or some such nonsense, and after all that hugger-mugger, it turned out to be nothing more or less than December 31st. And then the next day was January 1st. By 3 o'clock the next afternoon, the whole thing began to seem incredibly silly. Like, 3 years later, this year, I'm not getting remotely the same vibe. Thursday is New Year's. And make no mistake, the newspapers are full of clubs and restaurants beckoning you to spend Wednesday nights with them, partaking of their holiday cheer. And this week, all the papers and magazines are doing their best-of-worst lists, and the obituaries of the year are popping up, quotable quotes by notable notes. So the media is in gear for the end of the year, but I'm not getting the frantic, well, where will you be when the ball drops, or, oh my God, I was supposed to go here, but I was invited here, but I really want to be here. I don't know. Maybe younger folks, high school kids, are making it a big deal. Or maybe it's also less of a grand to-do, not just because we're post-millennial, but because we're post-apocalyptic. After September 11th, worrying where to spend 9 p.m. to midnight on New Year's Eve somehow lost its giddy significance. And also, I think we're getting a little blitzed out by Christmas at this point. Now, I've done the rant before of how I'm getting sick to death of Christmas, not on December 25th. Not on November 25th, but by the end of October, because the radio stations and TV stations and the stores have conspired to start the Christmas season the week before Halloween. Used to be, they'd at least wait until the 1st of December. Then they pushed it back to the day after Thanksgiving, because the Friday was always such a natural shopping day. Well, recently they moved it back to the day after Halloween. November 1st, all the card stores push away all the ghosts and goblins and roll in all the Santas and Rudolphs. Now, that's still the case. But now we're seeing Christmas advertising and infomercials halfway through October. And starting in November, radio stations either go all Christmas all the time, or every third song is some loathsome holiday standard. Okay, now, I'm Jewish, so it's true the holiday has no particular pull for me. But even Christians must get a little overwhelmed with the whole seasonal onslaught. Instead of panicking, oh dear God, where am I going to go on New Year's Eve? Now it's, oh sweet Jesus, it's a week before Christmas and I don't have all my shopping done. And the fact that Christmas music is now omnipresent, on the radio, in the stores, in offices, I don't think there's a popular music artist with one album to their credit that doesn't have a Christmas CD out somewhere, or they're at least on some Christmas benefit compilation album. Forget the 12 days of Christmas. We all need the 12 steps of Christmas to wean us off America's relentless addiction to this holiday. And what it's done is taken the excitement out of New Year's Eve. The holidays are so close together anyway that it used to be nice. The Christmas season would dovetail into New Year's, a week or so of merriment and courtesy and good cheer before the heaviness of winter really set in. But now everybody's so stressed out and freaked out and worn out by Noel that Nuevo Año is like, what, another holiday already? But I'm not negating the spirit of New Year's. On the contrary, I think it can be a very cool and positive holiday, regardless of whether you make or keep or break any resolutions. Going back to 2001 and 9/11, I think that was the real demonstration of the value of New Year's. 2001 was a pretty mediocre year for a while. Bush was in the White House. We were sliding into a recession. Free speech and personal freedoms were just starting to be curtailed by the Republican administration. And then, bang, September 11th. And the rest of that year was just a blur of terror, terrorism, worry, economic distress, inconvenience, instability. All anybody wanted to do was get over that period. And it dragged on for weeks, and yes, it dragged on well into the following year, and to some extent it's still dragging on now. But at least there was a natural barrier, a small barrier reef, made of sand but still tangible, between 2001 and 2002, New Year's Day and Eve. And all you heard people saying was, goodbye 2001, good riddance, what a horrible year. It's like the Counting Crows song I played on this show the past New Year's, A Long December. It's been a long December, and there's reason to believe maybe this year will be better than the last. And hey, at the end of 2001, there wasn't much reason to believe 2002 would be an improvement, but it kind of was. The economy was in the dumper, but we certainly didn't have another cataclysmic spasm. And then this year, well, more of a return to normalcy, more of a sense of optimism, and whether it's real or illusory or temporary, a pickup in the economy, the stock market leaping over 10,000, the housing market still robust, unemployment maybe under control, that's the real X factor here that could make everything go crashing down again, unemployment and whether wages of people working cover the expenses and health insurance, still, taken as a year. I'm not talking personally. Obviously, I can't know if you're out there listening and thinking, I lost my father, my grandmother died, my business collapsed, I had an operation, I'm on chemotherapy. I mean, 1928 seems like a pretty fantastic year historically. But I'm sure there were a few folks who were beset by illness or death or misery, and they couldn't wait for it to be 1929. And maybe on a financial level, they were lucky and protected from the Depression, and therefore 1929 was an improvement. We could call 1941 one of the worst years in American history, and 1945 one of the best. But people still suffered and died, at home and overseas, even as the war was ending. So you really can't presume to tell someone, oh, this year was definitely on the upswing, because you can't make those judgments for other people. All I can do on this program is say that, for myself, I had a lot to be thankful for, and as years go, thank God I can't complain. And I hope you're in a position to think the same thing. All in all, it was a pretty good year.
Tears on the sleeve of a man, don't wanna be a boy today. The eternal footman bought himself a bike to race. And Greggy writes letters and burns his CDs. They say you are something in those formative years. Well, hold on to nothing as fast as you can. Pretty good.
Tori Amos from the Under the Pink album. That's the one where she suckles the pig for some reason. Pretty Good Year. And that's the title of this episode of Dave's Gone By. And as I said, I hope this has been a pretty good year for all of you listening. If nothing else, I've had a great year being on the radio with you, doing this show, Dave's Gone By, moving from late Sunday nights in 2002 to primetime weeknights a couple of months back, and having great guests doing songs and comedy bits, joking about the news, reviewing theater, bantering with Engineer Joe. It has been good. So forgive me if I allow myself a little self-indulgence on this episode. Later on, I just want to take a few minutes and be thankful for some of the good stuff that has come my way this year, both on the air and off. Now, the idea is not for me to pontificate about the minutiae of my life. I'll be pretty general about it. But in doing so, maybe spark the same kind of positive reflection for you in your life. Now, this is not touchy-feely radio. I'm not going to get all spiritual and religious or moralistic about count your blessings and don't wait until the well runs dry and then remember how good the water tasted. I just want to share a few things that made 2003 a pretty good year and, in that way, close it on a pretty nice note. But that's later in the program. Before that, a bit of a treat. One of the segments we do pretty often on this show is called Dave's Gone Cultural. That's where we talk about books or movies or something in the cultural realm. Usually it's theater. A couple of weeks ago, I basically spent the whole segment raving about Wonderful Town, the revival of that Leonard Bernstein, Comden and Green Broadway musical. And I was happy to do it. It was a terrific show. It is a terrific show. But I neglected so much else that's been going on in the theater these past few weeks. Late fall is a very busy time on Broadway. And this year, it was like rush hour at Grand Central with so many productions opening. So I wanted to play catch-up, or at least make an attempt. And what better way to do that than with my good friend Charlie Gross. He's been on the program, I think, 3 times before. Always an absolutely lively and knowledgeable and fun guest when we're talking about the theater, and tonight it's 4 big Broadway musicals. So, if you've got a limited budget or family coming in for the holidays, and you're still deciding what shows to go see, and you can't get tickets to the producers, well, there are 4 major musicals clamoring for your patronage. Well, you know you should see Wonderful Town, but what about Taboo? That's the one starring Boy George and produced by Rosie O'Donnell. Or maybe you're a Wizard of Oz fan and are curious about Wicked, a new musical from Stephen Schwartz. That's the guy who gave us The Magic Show and The Baker's Wife. Or if your taste runs to something more in the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers mode, what about Never Gonna Dance, which, despite its title, features acres of dancing? Charlie and I will talk about, and probably argue about, all these shows on this year-end edition of Dave's Gone By, our 58th episode, each and every one hosted by yours truly, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, theater critic, editor, and humorist. Each and every episode trying to be a mix of smart talk, silly talk, special talk, and music. And each and every episode is rated DGB-13. The Dave's Gone By equivalent of PG-13, which means some of the jokes and content may not be suitable for every single person, but every married person, no problem. Anyhow, enough of the introductions. Let's talk a little theater. We've got Charlie Gross, respected drama critic and host of Manhattan Cable TV's Two on the Isle, coming up on Dave's Gone Cultural, which will begin a mere minute and a half from now. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and a little segment that we like to call Dave's Gone Cultural. Usually, we talk about theater. Sometimes we talk about books, or music, or arts, and things like that. But, yeah, we're going to do theater, since it's basically the end of the year. Time for wrap-ups and all these fall shows coming through that we should talk about on and off Broadway. Sometimes I talk about it by myself, but it's more fun when I debate and argue and criticize with other people, and rarely is it more fun than when I do it with this special guest. I think he's been on the program 2 or 3 or maybe 4 times already. Even that isn't enough. We need him back one more time at least. His name is Charlie Gross, and I want to welcome him to Dave's Gone By.
It's great to be here. I hope I can be worthy of that wonderful introduction.
You usually are, dude. And if you're not, you know, we'll just never invite you back and you know, criticize you endlessly.
Fair enough. You know, it's just I'm happy to return all the favors you've done me by appearing on Two on the Isle, my show.
And we know what kind of favors, don't we? God forbid. Hey, people are going to hear you on this segment for a little while, but where else can they hear you, dude?
Well, they can hear me. If you live in Manhattan or in parts of Bergen County, New Jersey, you can see me on the old tube, Two on the Isle. That is kind of a Siskel and Ebert program, which I do with my good friend Jeff Goodman, except that we talk about the theater. So if you want to keep up to date on what's good and what's not on and off Broadway, that's the place to go. If you don't live in an area that we air, you can see us every other Tuesday night at www.mnn, that's like Mary Nancy Nancy, .org, at 10:30 p.m., and then just click on, once you get to the website, click on Channel 34, and the show is streamed as it's broadcast. And even if you've got a dial-up connection, you can still come on and hear us, and it's pretty cool.
Damn. Please watch Charlie and Jeff. They've been doing their show for many years now, and it's a lot of fun. Hopefully, about as much fun as we're going to have over the next bunch of minutes, talking about all the Broadway shows that came colliding into the end of the year, halfway through the Broadway season. Just sticking with Broadway now,
busiest,
no off-Broadway.
Busiest one in memory, by the way.
Yeah.
And possibly, the way things are going, it may be the most successful one. Quite some time.
Successful in quality or successful in money? Or
I was thinking successful in money, but there have been some there have been some good shows.
Okay. Musically, of the recent crop, which one you like the best?
Musically, I think my favorite has to be the revival of Wonderful Town. This is one of my all-time favorite musicals and perhaps one of the most overlooked musicals ever, especially when you consider that Leonard Bernstein did the music, Hamden and Green did the lyrics, and anytime you see a Bernstein biography, they'll say, oh, he wrote On the Town, and he wrote Candide, and he wrote West Side Story, and they'll kind of think, oh, yeah, he wrote Wonderful Town, too.
Mm.
But this musical has a score as good as anything else he wrote, and that's saying something. And this is its first time back on Broadway since it originally opened, I think, in 1953, with Rosalind Russell. This is based on the book and subsequent movie, My Sister Eileen. It's about two young women coming from Ohio to Greenwich Village in 1935 at a time when a woman's virtue was worth more to her than getting a role, when an unmarried couple...
Getting a role? What?
Than getting a role in film.
Oh, that kind of role.
Yeah, sacrifice her virtue to advance her career. Or when a couple living together without benefit of marriage could still be considered shocking.
Hmm.
Or even a cop on the beat who actually walks into an apartment when requested and evicts a prostitute.
Right, but with an Irish accent.
Yeah,
and
apparently in those days, every cop, including black ones, talked with Irish accents. And apparently every street corner in Greenwich Village had a 24-piece orchestra.
Well, I think that's still true, you know. Because they can't get regular jobs in this
economy. And I have to say, that's a highlight of the show, by the way.
Was what?
The fact that there is a 24-piece orchestra, orchestrated, I think, the way it was in the original production. No electronics.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible. I didn't think having the orchestra on stage would work. That's not how they did it originally. But
originally meaning when they did it at Encores about 3-4 years ago? Or originally?
No, originally when they did it on Broadway.
Okay.
And as you mentioned, this is a transfer from Encores. A lot of cast changes have been made, but they have retained Donna Murphy,
mm-hmm.
who as Ruth Sherwood, a smart talk, a girl sometimes a little too smart for her own good, who wants to be a writer, and her very pretty sister, Eileen, who wants to be an actress. And it's a hilarious combination. Donna Murphy, who won Tony's for Passion, and The King and I, neither performance really did much for me, is absolutely incredible here.
Yeah, she's dynamic and funny and fun. I never saw Rosalind Russell do, or maybe I did when I was a kid.
Well, if you want to see Rosalind Russell do it, you can actually go to the Museum of Television. And they did do a TV version of it with Rosalind Russell, and it's definitely worth a look.
Was she in My Sister Eileen, or was that not even starring her, the non-musical original?
She was in the non-musical.
Right, maybe I saw that. With
and
her, but
very possible, and that is why she had been asked to do the musical, because she didn't have much of a range. And if you notice, most of the time, Donna Murphy kind of sings with this Rosalind Russell slash Jimmy Durante type growl.
Wah, 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 wah.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, yeah.
Because that's how the score was written, because Rosalind Russell had a range of about four notes. However, every so often, you know, she'll just let loose just to remind us that she's got a range far beyond.
Yeah, that's one of the beauties of the performance. You know, she's being funny, she's being zany, and kind of like uptight zany, which mm-hmm. the character is. And then in the end of the first act, when they do the conga number, she lets loose and it's like, ooh, who's that hottie?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh yeah, it's Donna Murphy, she's hot, yeah.
Or this wonderful number called 100 Easy Ways to Lose a Man, where she describes how a girl who's a little too smart for her own good
right, exactly.
can intimidate him. And remember, this is 1935. So
it is that far back, yeah.
What?
Yeah, I didn't remember the time frame of the show, but it isn't just Donna Murphy's show. I think what's nice about Jennifer Westfeldt, who's best known for directing and starring in Kissing Jessica Stein, mm-hmm. is Eileen.
Yeah.
She's the so-called pretty one, and she is, and she's fun and bubbly and adorable and a little bit knowing, which is just right,
yes.
And a lot of good side characters, too. I spent almost a whole segment on this particular show a couple of weeks ago, because I liked Wonderful Town so much.
And it's well worth it, because this is really an incredible show that is finally, I think, getting the recognition it deserves, and it's such a wonderful production. I mean, not big on the set and scenery, but I don't think the original was either, and it's not a show that really relies on that. This is a show that's very musically driven, very character driven, and the producers have given us this beautiful orchestra, a very talented cast, starting with Donna Murphy.
Yeah, and it's talented, and it's set piece driven. It's comedy sketches in a way, when they're all stuck together, you know, having dinner in that little apartment, and or mm-hmm. when they're at that nightclub, you know, these things go in a farcical way, and that's what makes it move to.
It's a strong story.
Yeah, and the other thing that what it did for me was it reminded me, or it showed me, that Comden and Green can still work, because the last couple of Comden and Green shows that made it to Broadway, you had
Bells
On the
Ringing,
Town.
Right. On the Town.
Bells and Ringing was kind of cute, kind of nice, but it was just didn't happen, even though it had Faith Prince. And then they had On the Town with, it's Lea Delaria. And that over-happened. It was too much. It was George C. Wolfe just throwing things at us very loudly, and it was like, ugh.
Well, I think that, you know, for that one, he took a major risk not using Jerome Robbins' choreography, and I don't think it quite gelled.
But for whatever reason, I was worried. I was getting like, gosh, maybe Comden and Green just, you know, they're not going to make it into the next century. Their things were cute, but they're stale now. They're not really working. And then this comes along, and it's like, oh, don't be ridiculous. Wonderful Town is terrific. But it's not the only show. It's not the only new musical. There's another one that longs to be old, and it's called Never Gonna Dance.
I think this is based very loosely on the Astaire Rogers movie Swing Time.
Mm-hmm.
And it concerns a dancer named Lucky, who basically has to figure out a way, I think, to make $20,000 or $25,000. This is also back in the 30s, roughly around the same time as Wonderful Town, without dancing to satisfy his would-be father-in-law. And he goes to the big city and suddenly finds himself on the Major Bowes Hour dancing with, Nancy...
Not sure I can pronounce it. Lemonager or Lemonager?
Lemonager, yeah.
Lemonager, okay.
The ginger in this role.
Right.
And suddenly he doesn't want to make $25,000.
Because if he does, he has to marry the guy's daughter. He made that promise.
Right, the daughter, and he's kind of falling in love with Penny, who is a dance instructor who he happens to run into, and she ends up with his lucky quarter, so he traces her to the dance studio. Along the way, he picks up a bum who's a former stockbroker.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dumb story. I found it was a pretty fun story. A lot of people were making fun of the show and saying, oh, the plot is really stupid, as if all the plots back then when these kinds of things were being done weren't dumb and weren't silly and were just a way to hang the story and some jokes, or to hang the songs and some jokes.
Right, well, the whole idea is to give them an excuse to dance, and they do.
Yeah.
The music is by Jerome Kern and assorted lyricists, including Dorothy Fields, Oscar Hammerstein, Ira Gershwin. It's like a who's who of lyricists for this score. And you have, of course, Never Gonna Dance and I Won't Dance. And
of course, they spend half the show dancing.
Yeah, Pick Yourself Up. I mean, there's a lot of dancing. And if you like the Astaire Rogers style, you're going to really enjoy this show. Yes, the book is a little silly, a little light, but it's got some lovely dance numbers.
Yeah, the thing about it is I found the dancing quite enjoyable. I thought some of the dance numbers went on too long, but mm-hmm. not being a dance aficionado, I felt that moving out. I felt that in contact. You know, I was like, okay, I get the idea that dancing is wonderful, on to the next subject, onto more story, or onto a new dance.
Right. Well, Contact, actually, the only one I actually enjoyed was the third segment, which was called Contact.
And
that
even that
worked for me.
That one was repetitious, but you didn't mind, because, you know, there's that girl in the yellow dress, and you're going, have da. But even that should have been about, you know, 5 minutes shorter, I thought.
I disagree on that, but you know what, that closed, so I won't. But as, you know, as far as Moving Out is concerned, I did not like the dancing in Moving Out. I'm a big Billy Joel fan. I did not really like Moving Out. Although I will connect this play to Contact because both of them have the wonderfully talented Karen Ziemba.
True.
Who, interestingly, has a more Rogers-like personality than the girl playing the Rogers role, and probably could have played this role herself. And said that she's kind of the sidekick.
I don't think she can dance that well. Ziemba is a pretty good singer, a decent dancer. I don't see her as a really great dancer, though.
Well, wasn't she in Crazy for You?
Yeah, even so. I mean, she's a talented singer and actor dancer, but not extraordinary in either one.
Mm-hmm. Well, she certainly does get to sing here, and she puts over some wonderful numbers. She doesn't actually do much dancing.
Yeah, and the thing about this is for me, the best part of it was watching the lead guy, Noah Racy, who plays the guy with the Lucky Garnet.
Yeah, that's the Astaire role, which kind of explains why he spends most of the play in a tux.
Right, but watching him dance is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I sort of wish he were a little taller like Astaire, and God knows as a short person, I know I'm sort of saying something sacrilege.
I don't think Astaire all that tall?
Whether he was, he looked tall, and he was also lanky and thin.
Yes.
So, you know, that and his dress made him look about 6.5 feet. I think he was pretty
Noah
tall.
Noah Racy, I think, really evokes the Astaire
5'10".
Style.
Yeah.
And perhaps to a lesser extent, the persona. He knows what's expected of him, and he knows how to deliver it. Astaire's a very hard act to follow.
But he's not a great singer. Astaire could sing pretty darn well.
He could put over a song very well. He didn't have a great voice, but he knew how to put over a song.
You're talking about Astaire?
Yes.
Yeah, he actually had a decent voice. Racy can just makes it. That's the one thing. I think they got people for the leads who can dance very, you know, make the dancing worthwhile and special. Mm-hmm. But they didn't find a way to get actors who could do all three smashingly well. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, sometimes when the songs are going on, these are supposed to be classic songs, and we feel like we're biding time,
mm-hmm.
Waiting for either the next dance or the next batch of jokes.
Right.
And the jokes I found very often very funny. I think, was it Jeffrey Hatcher who adapted the book? So, all in all, enjoyable.
Yes.
And absolutely worth a fun evening at the theater. Could have been better, mm-hmm. but certainly could have been a lot worse. I hope it makes it. On to something more modern. There were two one-word new musicals out,
yes.
And they're both rather dark in their way. Mm-hmm. One is based on an old thing, and one is based on a recent thing. Which would you rather talk about first, Wicked or Taboo?
I think I'd like to go with Wicked.
Elfie, now that we're friends, I've decided to make you my new project.
You really don't have to do that.
I know. That's what makes me so nice.
Whenever I see someone less fortunate than I, and let's face it,
who isn't?
Less fortunate than I, my tender heart tends to start to bleed. And when someone needs a makeover, I simply have to take over. I know exactly what they need. And even in your case, though it's the toughest case I've yet to face, don't worry, I'm determined to succeed. Follow my lead, and yes, indeed, you will be popular. You're gonna be popular. I'll teach you the proper points when you talk to boys. Little ways to flirt and glance. Ooh, I'll show you what shoes to wear, how to fix your hair. Everything that really counts to be popular. I'll help you be popular. You'll hang with the right cohorts. You'll be good at sports. Know the slang you've got to know. So let's start, 'cause you've got an awfully long way to go.
you'll be. Instead of dreary, who you were, well, are. There's nothing that can stop you from becoming popular. Lar. Look at you. You're beautiful.
I have to go.
You're welcome. And though you protest your disinterest, I know clandestinely you're gonna grin and bear it, your newfound popularity.
Is a very interesting concept. I mean, there are certain givens that we've always had. For example, you know, things can get very vague these days. I mean, you get a terrorist like Yasser Arafat winning the Pulitzer Prize.
I mean the Nobel.
I'm sorry, that's not the Pulitzer, the Nobel Prize.
Although Pulitzers were based on a guy who manufactured dynamite, so it would make a certain kind of logical sense. But no, I don't think Arafat ever won the Pulitzer.
No. That's a German.
Although, you know what? I would pick him.
And
over
I guess
Edward
we're not
going
to win one after this either. For that era. But or if you read, you know, the comic books, the villains, you know, have these deep, dark issues, and that's why they're villains. But the one thing we could always count on was the Wicked Witch of the West. This woman, especially as personified by Margaret Hamilton in The Wizard of Oz, was evil, period.
Yeah,
well,
and especially evil when she was on her period. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to get into that.
Okay. Well, neither could anyone else, but, you know, that's why she was wicked. Anyway.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, this sounds like a whole this topic for another segment.
Let's stay away from the word hole, shall we? Okay! I don't know why I'm doing this.
I don't
Go
know
on, tell us more about Wicked, though.
Okay, well, Wicked is, basically, Wicked is a revision of the Oz legend. It's kind of a different path down the yellow brick road, where we learn that not only does the witch have a name, Elphaba, which is, I think, a derivative of L. Frank Baum, who wrote the book.
Yep, mm-hmm.
But she wasn't actually, not only that, she wasn't so bad. Glinda, the good witch, wasn't so good, and the wizard was both a bad man and a bad wizard, it turns out. In this version, where you have Glinda personified by Christian Chenoweth, who was incredible, and Elphaba, the wicked witch, portrayed by Idina Menzel, also incredible.
Yep.
You basically chose their history together. They were roommates in college. Glinda was very popular. Elphaba, who is green and shunned because she's green, which I find interesting because she lives in the Land of Oz where the main city is all green in the Emerald City. So
I know, that's a wonderful moment in the show where she finally gets to visit the Emerald City.
Right.
And she goes, oh, my God. Everything is green. It's actually quite touching.
She feels she fits in, yeah. Although I always felt, well, you know, if the Emerald City is green and that's the pinnacle of Oz, a green woman probably shouldn't be made to feel out of place, but that's another story. Anyway, Elphaba was very talented magically and eventually brought to see the wizard, kind of to work with him. Turns out the wizard's got this whole PR campaign going against talking animals because he feels they're making them scapegoats.
Literally. There's actually
yeah,
a goat
literally
professor,
in one case, because we do run into a talking professor goat at the university where Glinda and Elphaba study. He can unite the population of Oz. Well, Elphaba, who, unlike her counterpart in the Wizard of Oz, in the original story, because she wanted to keep the cowardly lion and make him work as a horse and wouldn't feed him until he... agreed to that,
mm-hmm.
But in this version, she is an animal rights activist, And so she and the wizard don't quite see eye to eye. The wizard uses his publicity mill to paint her as wicked, and the story goes on from there. And Glinda kind of falls in with the wizard, not really wanting to, but she likes to be popular, and she likes being, they dub her Glinda the Good, and eventually she kind of grows out of it. I don't want to give too much away.
Well,
but
they become true friends.
Yeah.
I mean, and they go through, even after they become friends. And that's one of the things that surprised me about the plot. And I think the book for Wicked is pretty terrific. It's Winnie Holtzman did the adaptation.
She did Stephen Schwartz did the score.
Yes.
I think it's one of his best, if not his best, scores, by the way.
I need to hear it some more. I need to listen to the cast album a bit more. There's some good stuff on it. Mm-hmm. I think he goes up and down. I think some of the rhymes are a little iffy, and music's good sometimes and okay others, but the book kept pulling me. It kept surprising me.
I will tell you,
found it very moving at times.
In the beginning it did. I mean, it shed some wonderful light on things like the Ruby Slippers and the hurricane that brought Dorothy to Oz, and those are very interesting revelations. But there are other things, like when they revise the origins of the Scarecrow and the Tin Men, that really fly in the face of both the movie and the original bound book. And it's very hard to accept. For example, in this case, the Tin Woodsman is not even a woodsman.
At
some point, at one point, the witch not being evil becomes the easiest part to accept. And there are certain
That. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite things about the show, is that Elphaba, for me, is an extremely sympathetic character most of the way. She's not perfect, even though we're supposed to sympathize and empathize with her as she has to start, you know, as everybody else is basically reviling her. And sometimes she's a loudmouth. She's a pain in the butt sometimes. Yeah. She knows she's unpopular, so she goes out there and makes herself doubly.
Ruth from Wonderful Town have something in common. They're both very talented.
Right, and they
and
don't know when to...
a little too aggressive at times.
Right. So, okay, she has that little failing that we accept in her. But then she gets roped into all these terrible circumstances out of being good.
And it's fascinating, and it's been, you know, lovely directed by Joe Mantello. When Elphaba, you know, first flies on her broom, the way they stage it is wonderful.
Yes,
It's a lot more creative than just having her literally fly on the broom.
Oh, yeah.
Which
Roseanne
Barr did in The Wizard of Oz a couple of years ago, but that's another story.
But it's true. This is one of the things also that I liked about the show is that it's a show. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that sounds silly to say, but it is spectacle.
Yes.
And they make good spectacle out of it. There's some good music. They've got two equally fabulous actresses. I mean, I know they gave, like, double nominations and maybe even a double win to those two actresses in Sideshow a couple of years ago when they played Siamese twins. Mm-hmm. So it was basically unfair or impossible to separate them at nominations time. Mm-hmm. Here we've got Chenoweth and Menzel, and they're not, you know, joined literally at the hip.
No.
And yet trying to figure out, well, who is better? Mm-hmm. You can't even... They're both extraordinary.
I would have to give the nod to Menzel because she's got the better part.
Okay.
I mean, that they're both extraordinary actresses. I disagree a bit with you about the book. It gets very predictable in the second.
What did you predict?
Who was going to be the Tin Man? Who was going to be the Scarecrow?
I wasn't even looking. I'm not a Wizard of Oz like a holic guy. I haven't seen the movie in years. I never even read the book, I don't have all that Oz background. I just have this vague memory of Yellow Brick Road and Bert Lahr and something about No Place Like Home.
Right. Well, it's very hard if you are familiar with it. It's at times very hard to reconcile, and in fact, the play, which does overlap with the movie at one point, isn't quite able to reconcile itself with it. And that was a problem that I had with it. And I think really the only way to enjoy it, if you are an Oz fan, is to basically say that this takes place in a different, is in an alternate universe or an alternate Oz.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think that's going in.
On it, and you know, just sit back and try to enjoy it. Joel Grey is the wizard. He does a nice job as that.
Right. I mean, he's a pro. Yeah. You look at it's not that flashy a role, even though it's a wizard. He's actually downplays the role because the wizard isn't really a big old whiz.
The wizards and Carol Shelley as the headmistress of the school that Elphaba and Glinda go to.
Yeah, she's very good. I didn't get to see the original actor, Norbert Leo Butz.
Yes.
That's his last name, folks, Norbert Leo Butz.
Yes.
He was out by the time I got to see it. He's had some illness or something.
He also performed, well.
I mean, he's the lead male kind of role who falls
right.
in love with, he should be falling in love, quote unquote, with Glinda the Good, but, you know, he's attracted to Alphaba, the so-called, as is everyone
else. Well,
but
he's attracted to her not because she's evil. He's attracted to her. He falls in love with her because of her, and, you know,
and
knows,
she's not evil. That's,
he
that's
knows
also,
the score.
Yeah.
Right.
And he sees behind it, and also, you know, let's face it, you know, Idina Menzel looks like a green supermodel.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
no,
Margaret Hamilton, you know, who was a lot older when she played the role, and, you know, I think they also gave her a nose and a chin, you know. They made her look ugly. Idina Menzel, they paint her green, and they just throw her on stage. She's a young, attractive woman.
Right, and
you
it's
know.
Like, just a lighter right. shade of green. Yeah, she looks like a C6 supermodel. That's about it. But
and just in case any of the creators of the show are listening, there were some touches that anyone who's bothered to read the book would notice.
Oh, like? Give us one.
All right. They all wore, if you notice, when they go to the Emerald City, everyone puts on glasses. And the supposed reason for that in the book was that you had to wear glasses, green glasses, because otherwise the brilliance of the city would blind you.
Oh.
And then we find out later in the book that you have to put on the green glasses because otherwise the city won't look green. It was a whole elaborate plot by the wizard.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I guess
there are a couple little touches like
yeah.
that.
Neat.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I liked Wicked a whole lot. It sounds like you, what? Where are you on it?
I enjoyed it less than you did. Again, I don't think the book, I wasn't as enamored with the book as you were toward the end, although, you know, it is a good one. And again, I had a little more trouble reconciling, you know, my memories and my knowledge of Oz with Wicked. But I did enjoy it.
So you were in, I hear Oz in the background where you are. Hey, we got time for one more musical.
You know, one last word on Wicked.
Go for it.
You know, unless you want to think it takes place in another Oz verse, it can be a little too far over the rainbow to be enjoyed. All right.
You really didn't have to do that. You really didn't, but thank
okay.
you for doing that.
Okay.
Taboo.
Taboo.
Was it taboo?
No, it wasn't.
No, it
now,
wasn't.
The question about Taboo is, can this show climb out of the shadow of its producer, Rosie O'Donnell?
Well, you know what? We were both there the same night,
yeah.
and what happened was at intermission, and this was just a week after it had opened, and
mm-hmm.
had gotten mostly pounded by the critics,
mm-hmm.
and so O'Donnell was in the audience, because she's producing the thing,
right.
and she was heading to her seat, and then, you know, everybody notices her, so they start talking, waving, she starts making an impromptu speech, saying, you know, mm-hmm. F the critics, and they don't know what they're talking about, and we've done this show, you know, every night for 3 weeks, and every night, 21 standing ovations, and, you know, almost guaranteeing, of course, that she'd get another one that night. And
right.
everybody applauded, and it's, you know, I did not applaud F the critics, but, mm-hmm. you know, okay, let's make believe, though, that Taboo wasn't produced by her. Let's make believe it was produced by Mike Nichols or the late David Merrick. Then
well,
what would you think of Taboo?
I suspect it would have been a very different show had either of them
right. yeah,
produced it. Taboo is an interesting show. Now, this is a show with music and lyrics by Boy George. And, among other things, it's a biography of Boy George, and it stars Boy George. But Boy George does not play Boy George.
He plays?
Boy George plays, who does Boy George?
Lee Bowery.
Yes, who was a performance artist and supposedly a mentor of Boy George. But, in actuality, it's kind of hard to tell. It takes place in the 80s. Here we finally have a musical that doesn't take place in 1936. In the club scene of the 80s.
Mm-hmm. English clubs, London clubs.
Right,
scene, yeah.
right. The focus, although it's a very soft focus, is on Boy George and, you know, how he came to town, you know, obviously gay, obviously in drag, and kind of suffered a bit because of it, and then he becomes this big star with Culture Club. But it also also introduces us to some of the other people, including Lee Bowery, who was played by Boy George, and
you maybe explain a little bit of what made Bowery quote unquote special, or at least to
well,
people around him.
Well, he was
him.
A very flamboyant person, and he was desperate to be. He was a performance artist who was interestingly gay, but in the show he's got two women constantly fighting over him, and he was desperate for recognition before he died,
mm-hmm.
and that's the other part of the show, although it never. Although his connection with Boy George, whatever it may have been, and I think obviously it was strong if George was writing about it, never quite comes. I mean, they kind of pass each way, and, you know, they travel in the same circle, but we really don't know. We never get an idea of what the connection was. And interestingly, we never even meet the other members of Boy George's band, Culture Club.
That's right. He gets famous, assumedly, as part of a group, but
yeah.
You never see the group.
Right. And, you know, while this isn't supposed to be a Culture Club musical, they do have Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, which is beautifully sung by, I think it's Owen Morton, who plays Boy George, looking more like Boy George than Boy George does these days.
I mean, Ewan, not a, it's Ewan, like an English kind of a name, yeah.
And they kind of shortchanged Karma Chameleon, which was their most popular hit. They give you a few bars, and it's a chance for them to really break loose and have a wonderful dance number. And you would think there'd be more dancing in a show about clubs.
True.
But they kind of just give a few bars, and hey, that's it. That's all, folks.
Yeah, it's... That's the thing about this show for me. I mean, I went really up and down on it while I was watching it.
Yeah.
Wait, I better rephrase that, considering the menu. But parts of it I thought were really fascinating and onto a very good, strong track. They were telling the story of a certain time with some very good music,
yeah.
Some very catchy stuff. You know, again, here's a CD that... Not only it's like, oh, okay, if they release a cast album, I'll give it a listen, but like, oh, there's like four or five songs I would really like to hear again.
To hear it. I enjoyed it when I heard it, but it didn't make as much an impression on me, possibly because I couldn't hear the lyrics half the time.
Mm. Well, I didn't have that much of a problem. I mean, with most Broadway shows now, they're mic'd so loud that you can't hear when the chorus sings anyway.
That's a definite problem.
But remember when I was harping on how much I liked the book for Wicked, because even though it's a little convoluted at times, and even though
right.
You know, a lot of stuff kind of gets zoomed in there at the end, you know, and this is someone's father and yada yada.
Right.
There's book issues never resolved in Taboo. They're telling three separate stories, and they just, it's like three parallel roads that don't intersect. You've got
right.
The Raul Esparza character, who is in many ways the most lively, the most
right, that's Philip Sellon. He's kind of the MC. In fact, this show opens, it's kind of, the opening scene, it's kind of like a combination of Cats and Cabaret.
Right.
I was sure I someone would be singing, you know, Wilkamum or Memories or...
Because he's got the leather and the makeup and it's like, hello!
Yeah.
Or how he, what he doing? He'd be like, hello!
Right.
Yeah.
And he's an interesting character, but we never really... learned too much about him. There's actually one character who I really enjoyed, and that was Big Sue, played by her stand-in that night, Brooke Elliott, who gave an incredible performance. Kind of resembles Rosie O'Donnell.
Yeah, I said that while we were watching it. I was like, oh boy, this is, you know, if this show isn't making money, that's the role Rosie's going to go into.
No.
And then that became a rumor that she really was.
Well, Rosie would have a very hard time matching Elliott's vocally.
Yeah, she admits that herself. She was asked about the rumor. And
really,
she said,
you know, came out, she gave an incredible performance, kind of like, must have been like what it was like when Shirley MacLaine understudied in Pajama Game. And I found that character, you know, who we learn has a kind of a day job, literally.
Yeah. No, I found her interesting. You're right. That's a character. Even more so, I sort of wanted to follow up. That was number four.
Yeah.
But there was no... There was a through line of Boy George and these people in this whole club scene.
Right.
But it didn't really all connect. So you had some great, interesting scenes and musical
right.
sequences, and then some
yeah.
other times when it's like, well, where's it... going, and this is
right.
kind of okay, but it doesn't connect to what just went before, and
yeah.
goes all over the place. Like, I like the,
it's very
yeah.
scattershot, you know, all the more disappointing because Charles Bush did the book.
Right. So there are laughs in it.
Say.
I'm sorry?
Rewrote the book.
Yeah.
For Broadway. Boy, you know, let's see, in addition to Brooke Elliott as Big Sue, I liked, how do you say, Ewan Morton
mm-hmm.
as Boy George. Raul Esparza was good
as
Philip.
Yeah.
Boy George himself, so is Lee. There's a wonderful scene in the show where Lee passes away, and then they do a montage. It'll last like a minute or two of the real Lee.
On film. They have photographs of him.
Yeah, photographs, and I think some movies also. And I got more of that guy's essence from that than I did from, you know, the whole evening.
Well, yeah, and I
watching Taboo.
I agree with that. I wonder if that's even fair, because here you are, I mean, how do you compete with showing actual footage of a person who was a very minor legend, but a legend of his time, and then showing him in his prime, and then going all the way back to when he was a young child, and then realizing, well, yes, he died of AIDS also. So, you know, they do all that in about a minute and a half, 2 minutes, and that is going to be powerful, the image, filmic image and real image. How can theater compete necessarily with that?
Well, it's got to find a way, otherwise you don't put it on stage.
Touché. Well put. So, would you recommend Wicked?
Would I recommend Wicked?
Oh, I'm sorry, not Wicked, Taboo.
Would I recommend Taboo?
Wicked I would definitely recommend. Would you recommend Taboo?
Would I recommend Taboo? It would really depend on who I was talking to. Certainly not to my parents.
Well, yeah, okay.
I think, you know, to someone who's a Culture Club fan, to someone who might have enjoyed Mamma Mia.
But not your sort of dyed-in-the-wool theater fan, you wouldn't really say, yeah, you really should see this.
It would, you know, of the shows that we've seen, again, it's not a bad show, per se. It's just...
Well, some people say it's a terrible show, so no. At least we're not in that camp.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but of the shows we discussed tonight, I think it is the weakest.
Hmm.
And it would be...
Well, I'll tell you, it's more interesting to me than Never Gonna Dance. I think...
And
as much as
it's
I like
got flashier
Never Gonna
costumes.
But you know what? Where's the backdrop? They put all the money of Taboo into the costumes and not a penny onto the set. So it's physically
ugly.
And it
still set Rosie back $10 million.
Yeah, she has it. She'll start another magazine. She'll get it back. Anyway, before I let you go, Charlie, it's been a thank you, first of all. This has been
my pleasure.
Great fun. All these plays have opened up, right? We'll talk about them, you know, next time. We'll have to do a part two on this, if you don't mind.
Love to.
But since we're ending the year here, any thoughts about the year in theater in general or the best shows of the whole 12-month period in 2003?
I'm just trying to remember what's opened in the last 12 months and what's still playing in the last 12 months.
I think my favorite of all would have been Take Me Out, the Richard Greenberg play that's closing January 4th. Any ideas on your end?
Well, I seem to be the only one who didn't like Take Me Out. I wasn't overly impressed with that show.
Hmm.
I certainly liked Avenue Q. I think
now,
that's the little show that could.
Yes, second choice right here.
Yeah.
Avenue Q is delightful. And what was the worst thing you saw all year?
Ooh.
Remember?
I'd have to get back to you on that.
All right, maybe in 04 you can...
Yeah, on that, because it's been a pretty good year, but there were a few bad shows.
Oh, yeah.
I've kind of blanked them out.
If you can keep doing that, you'll be a theater goer and a theater critic forever. You remember the great ones and the bad ones you only bring out at parties to laugh about. Anyway, speaking of things to see and to enjoy and to laugh about and argue about, remind us, please, where people can see and hear you and Jeff Goodman.
Okay. Well, Two on the Isle is seen every other Tuesday at 10:30 p.m., most places you can see it on the web, www.mnn, as in Manhattan Neighborhood Network, .org, and then just click on Channel 34. You have to do it on Tuesday at 10:30, and again, it's every other Tuesday, because the show is streamed as it's broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
If you live in Manhattan, you're a lot luckier. You just switch on Channel 34, and you can watch it at the same time. We're also on in parts of Bergen County, New Jersey. Unfortunately, I don't know where and when these days, but we are there, and we're seen weekly.
Well, I mean, who cares? It's New Jersey.
Lots of nice people care about it.
Yeah, I guess.
Parents live in New Jersey.
Actually, your parents are very nice, I have to say that. And you're very nice, Charlie. You're always nice for coming on this show and being so interesting and so knowledgeable and so much fun. Happy holidays. Happy New Year to you. Good theatering. Thanks again, Charlie Gross.
Okay.
Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time to trust my instincts. Close my eyes. And leap, it's time to try, defying gravity. I think I'll try, defying gravity, and you can't pull me down.
Can't I make you understand, you're having delusions of grandeur.
I'm through accepting limits, cause someone says they're so.
come with me. Think of what we could do together.
Unlimited. Together we're unlimited. Together we'll be the greatest team there's ever been. Glenda, dreams the way we plan them. If we work in tandem, there's no fight we cannot win. Choosing this.
You too.
I hope it brings you bliss. I really hope you get it and you don't live to regret it. I hope you're happy in the end. I hope you're happy, my
told me.
10,000 Maniacs there from Our Time in Eden. These are days, and these are the days, and the Daves, I guess I should say, Daves Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. Slightly self-indulgent part of the program here. On Thanksgiving, you may remember, if you were listening to that show, I played Ian Dury's Reasons to be Cheerful and spoke a bit about all the different things that we might be cheerful about. So this segment is kind of an extension of that. It's about being grateful, trying to appreciate some of the good things that happened in the past 365 days. So it can be old stuff, too, by the way. It can be a record album from the 1970s that I still got pleasure out of listening to on a rainy day 30 years later. So it's that kind of thing. It's very general, very loose, but just a way of wrapping up this year and saying thank you for some really nice things that made the year go by in a pleasant way much of the time. So anyway, it's kind of a listy thing, and I was going to do up like 100 different things, and then I ran out of time, and I didn't think there would be time on the episode to do it anyway. So I jotted down a dozen or two dozen, going to go through them fairly quickly, and again, hope that as meaningful as these things are to me, in big and little ways, you'll find similar things that are meaningful to you. For example, one thing I'm kind of happy about already is that the days are starting to get longer by now. You know, we've had the solstice and the shortest days of the year. Well, you know what? I know we're just getting into winter, but at least it's going to start to get or stay lighter out a little bit longer each day. So if we've gotten past that hub, be happy about that. Another thing that makes me happy, my wife and I have two wonderful, beautiful dogs, two dachshunds, one a smooth red and one a very shaggy, wire-haired dog, and sometimes they cause us a little bit of trouble, but they bring us an incredible amount of joy. So, happy about those two. Happy about the new Jewish hip. No, not a hip replacement or anything like that, but this new thing that they reported on, it was either in Time Out or New York Magazine, and the vanguard of these Jewish comedians and this Jewish style, like the Hebrew Hammer and Sarah Silverman, where Judaism is both old style, funky, weird, kind of making fun of but still loving the old ways, and then this new sexy, funky, hip, weird thing that's going on, and it's still becoming whatever it's going to be, but kind of neat to be, as you know, a Jew, part of a vanguard thing. That doesn't happen very often. Still in the vanguard, after, 11 seasons, 12 seasons on the air, The Simpsons. Don't necessarily get to watch it every week, but probably watch it a few times a week thanks to reruns all over the place, and I don't get tired of them. The Simpsons remain extraordinary back from the first episodes up through this very season. Also, some long-running heavy hitters who make the year worth yearing, Conan O'Brien and David Letterman. Just you tune them in, and you might not see them for a couple of weeks. You put them on, and they give you a giggle, they give you a laugh. Why not? It's kind of neat to see Triumph the Insult comic dog breaking off from Conan and having a career of his own without that very funny video. I also like some of Jay Leno's work when he's not being really smarmy, but he does those funny headlines, and every time I catch them, I get a couple of belly laughs. What else? Belly laughs, too, from the Cartoon Network. God bless those people for having such a strange and unusual block of programming, and funny block of programming on Sunday nights, including my current favorite, Aqua Teen Hunger Force, with beloved Meatwad. And I'm also totally falling for Carl now and his attitude. It's like, what do you want? Just here, wait, I think I have something here for you. It's in my gun. But you have to see the show to understand that. You, even after you see it, you might not understand it the first few times. And the same goes for Brack and the Oblongs and the Duckman reruns that they're showing. Duckman was just one of the greatest cartoons ever. And then you can go to the tamer stuff on one of the other channels, I forget which, that shows SpongeBob SquarePants. It's still a very, very fun show. Other things that I loved and liked about this year, being able to listen to Dr. Demento on the internet, that's a joy for me. being able to listen to Glenn Jones's radio program with his pal X-Ray Burns on WFMU on Sunday afternoons, being able to listen to Irwin Shusid, another FMU guy, and he doesn't do his show Incorrect Music anymore, that I really used to love, where they would play all the most bizarre and nutty talents you could think of, like Shuby Taylor and Wesley Willis, and people you've really, really never heard of deservedly. You can still hear that on the internet. They've got a website, incorrectmusic.com, so you can go there, or you can hear Irwin's other show on FMU. It was nice to see Rodney Dangerfield alive and somewhat well, recovering, losing a hell of a lot of weight, being on some award show on Comedy Central. I mean, here's a guy who was essentially given up for dead, and he's not. He's fine. Great. Welcome back, Rodney. And another guy who made me laugh this year and last year, Louis Black, a very funny comedian. Al Franken gives me a lot of laughs, and I'm just starting to read his book, Lying Liars and the Lies Who Tell Them, or something like that. And then on the opposite side of the field, Bill O'Reilly. I don't really watch his show, but I admire his professionalism and how well he does what he does. Let's see, other things that I really get a kick out of or help me out over the year. Thermal underwear! My gosh, I've been wearing them for years now all winter long, and let me tell you something, folks, when they tell you layers, they're not kidding, and when they tell you that a good pair of thermals will get you through the winter, it is true, even more than a flu vaccine or a flu nasal thing. Hey, that's another thing I'll be thankful for. You know, when they really perfect this nasal flu mist thing so that you don't have to get shots anymore. That's fabulous. Also, DVDs. Hooray for DVDs. What a wonderful way to watch a movie now. No real rewinding. Oh, sure, you have to sit through the first trailers while the thing's going, but, you know, you've got the special extra features, and you can zip through them and pause them, and the picture's really good. You get subtitles. Yay for DVDs. Hooray for newspapers that we read, or I read every day. I kind of take them for granted and zip through them pretty quickly, but it's fun to just sort of zip through a newspaper, including like the New York Press and the Village Voice, which are very subjective, and I mostly disagree with both of them all the time, and yet they're free, so why not, and they have funny cartoons. Be happy we captured Saddam Hussein. It might not mean anything in the war on terrorism, but he's a bad guy. And we got him. Hey, hooray for the army, huh? And be happy for the internet. Saves us a zillion dollars in postage, and it's still in its infancy. I mean, we're talking about downloading music and being able to listen to that and then listen to or see movies soon and television through the internet, still in its babyhood. But watch out, and I'm glad we have it now. Glad we have Law and Order on TV. It's like comfort food. Nothing else to watch on the dial. You come to one of the many Law and Orders, and yes, there are too many of them, and they all kind of follow a formula, but that makes them very kind of mellow and watchable, even as the subject matter is usually pretty awful. So, happy about that. Of course I'm happy about Broadway, and shows like Take Me Out, and Wonderful Town, and Wicked, and Avenue Q, and Golda's Balcony, and actresses like Donna Murphy in Wonderful Town, and Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel in Wicked, who just show you that there's a specialness about them and what they do that just nails you, and you can't explain it, you just watch it and enjoy it. Thank you, God, thank you for food. The Quail at Marché in Boston, this sweet little sort of cafe-style restaurant. And thanks for pizza and popcorn and edamame and dumplings and spare ribs and Indian bread and garlic pistachio nuts at Trader Joe's. I told you, this segment is all over the place. It's self-indulgent, but I think, you know, if you're not drooling already over the food, you're getting where I'm going with it. And I do want to take a little bit more time just to be happy about stuff that we had on this show. Some of the wonderful people who were our guests, like October Project, and the opera fanatic Stefan Zucker, and the terrific critics like Charlie Gross, whom we heard before, Jeff Goodman, Jeannie Lieberman, Richmond Shepherd. We've also had other guests from all walks of life, like Michael Artsis, and actor Robert Clohessy, and Todd Robbins, who does that off-Broadway show Carnival Knowledge and sticks nails up his nose, and my cousin, David Levine, who talked to me about Prague, and Lenora Campos, who talked to me about toilets. There was theater historian Ellis Nasur and satirist Bruce Kluger. He was fun to talk to. And David Spencer and Stephen Witkin, who were working on a musical called The Fabulous. They talked about that as well. All these terrific people, and how could I forget the engineers at GBB? Engineer Dennis, Engineer Tom Ross, and, of course, Engineer Joe Salzone. I'll give him his special thank you just a little bit later. And how could I forget all the friends, Scott and Tanya and Yelena, and my other good friends, Ozer, Leanne, and Paul, and Aditi, and Nihal, and Gregoire. Just happily, more people than I unfortunately can remember at the moment or can count. My circle of critic friends from the Drama Desk and the Outer Critics Circle and the American Theater Critics Association, and then even the closer circle of my mom and dad, who are just terrific and wonderful and perfect. And I know I'm being biased, but I don't care. They just are, because they're my mom and dad. And my family, Bonnie, Les, Adam, Stephanie, Josh, Brett, Esther, Deborah, Bobby, Alex, all of them. And how can I forget my fantastic and loving and beloved wife, Joyce? These are all people who, how shall I put it, they made my year. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Hope you've been enjoying all the comedy and the music, not just tonight, but all year long. Got just a couple of minutes left, so normally this is the place in the show where we do the thank yous, but since we did those in the last segment, you're spared most of that, though I do want to give an extra thank you very much to Charlie Gross for joining me in our cultural segment, and a big thank you as ever for the whole year to Engineer Joe Salzone. Listen to his millions of shows on this radio station, including Your World with Joe Salzone, Radio at the Speed of Now, Sundays at 6, Your World with Joe Salzone Television at the Speed of Now, and that is Sundays at 1 on Channel 20 Cablevision. You can also catch him on Your World After Dark on GBB, Sunday nights at 11, and Live at Night with Joe Salzone, Mondays at 11. And you can even hear him just before my show on Monday nights, 6 o'clock on GBB. Another GBB person, Bonnie D. Graham, hostess of Long Island's Dating, a show for singles, Friday nights at 6. Thank you also to the Tandoor Grill, my wonderful sponsors at 222 Sunrise Highway in Rockville Center. Lunch, dinner, takeout, delivery, they've got a downstairs party room, everything except a waterbed. Tandoor Grill, check tandoorgrill.com, not tandoori, there's no I, you leave that last I off for Indialicious. And of course, biggest thank you of all to all of you for your support and your listenership. Write me letters, send me email, davesgoneby@aol.com, davesgoneby, no apostrophe, @aol.com, and do check the website, hometown.aol.com/davesgoneby for pictures and information about the show. You can buy my book, you can buy cassettes of past episodes. Have a wonderful time and never leave your computer. hometown.aol.com/davesgoneby. That's the outro music, the Waterboys' Sweet Thing off the Fisherman's Blues collection. I rarely get to announce it, but hey, it's the last time you'll be hearing it in 2003, and it will be 7 whole days until you hear it again in 2004. My God, 2004. January 5th, 2004 to be exact. That is our next show, next Monday, 6:30 p.m., the 59th edition of Dave's Gone By. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night, pretty good year, and gone by.
I will go a merry way and jump the hedges first. Drink the clear, clean water for to quench my thirst. And I will watch the ferry boats and they'll get high. Against the blue ocean, against the moral sky.